out on a hillside. Nuada chuckled.
Come with us, mighty hero, protect us.
Us?
Yes, Arion is accompanying me.
Chlor's face flushed, and his eyes showed a murderous gleam. He stroked his red-gold beard, struggling for calm.
You think it is wise to take a child into Groundsel's lair?
He asked. Nuada laughed aloud and hoisted the pack to his shoulders.
Child, Chlor? He mocked. Are you blind? She is a woman, and a damn fetching one.
Surely you have noticed.
What I notice or don't notice is my own affair, snapped the outlaw. How long will you be gone?
Admit it, you'll miss me.
Go on, be a man, admit it.
Uttering a foul curse, Chlor rose and stormed from the cabin, almost colliding with Arion, but stopping at the last minute by grabbing her shoulders. Mumbling an apology, he stalked off towards the hills. Nuada was right. Chlor would miss him. He was bright company, and his stories wove webs of magic that could make a man forget he lived in a forest, in a dark cabin. They could ease the pain of loss, and make the world seem a place of heroes and enchantment. Without him, this was merely another mud-swamped settlement, with no hope and no future. Chlor's thoughts flew to Lydia, the wife of his heart, a beautiful woman, strong and yet caring. He found his feelings for Arian a betrayal of Lydia's memory, and hoped her ghost would forgive him. Seeing Lamfada and the cripple Elladan working to build the winter wood supply, he tried to walk past without stopping, but Elladan waved, and he knew it would be churlish to ignore them.
"How goes it?" he asked. "There will be fuel for the winter," replied Elladan. "Has Nuada gone yet?"
"No."
"He will be missed here, I think. I hope he's not away too long. I never heard a finer storyteller," said Elladan. "I first knew him in Firbolg. He put on a performance for the king. It was the tale of Asmodin. Oh, superb! The king, may the gods rot his soul, gave Nuada a ruby the size of a goose egg."
"He doesn't have it now," said Chlor gleefully.
"No, I understand he gave it to a lady for a single night of pleasure."
"The more fool him," snapped Chlor, thinking of the two-day journey the poet was about to undertake with Arion. But then all Nuada could now offer her was a second pair of woolen leggings and a threadbare blanket. Even so, the slender poet was a handsome man, Chlor cursed.
"What is wrong?" Elladan asked.
"Nothing," said Chlor, striding off.
"Is he sick, do you think?"
Lamfada whispered.
"No, he is in love," answered Elladan, chuckling.
"But then, in my experience, that is very much the same."
Chlor stopped at his cabin and sat staring at his Spartan surroundings. Then, with a muttered curse, he packed his belongings in a canvas shoulder sack, tucked a double-headed axe into his belt, and walked from the settlement without a backward glance. Cithaeron was the place to be, he decided. He could get work in a smithy there and build a new life. As he topped the line of hills, he heard a distant howl. It chilled his blood. The wolves were out early this year, he thought, and walked on. Nuada stepped into the sunshine and watched the outlaw crest the hill. Arion stopped beside him.
"What are you looking at?"
"Chlor, I think he's leaving us."
"Ridiculous," she snapped. "He's making his life here."
Nuada looked at her and grinned.
"Lead on, lady," he said. "I shall follow your beauty to the ends of the earth."
"Fool."
"Indeed I am. It is the fate of poets."
He hoisted his pack to his back and waited.
"What about weapons?" she asked.
"I have little use for them. But I have no fear. You will be there to guard me from the evils of the wild."
His violet eyes sparkled with humor. Arion was unsure of Nuada. In the days she had known him, He had made no secret of the fact that he found her attractive, yet not once had he made a move to court her. But then, she reasoned, this was a man who had moved among the ladies of the court, with their soft perfumed skin and their clothes of silk.
"Let us go," she told him, moving off across the settlement.
He strolled some paces behind her, enjoying the swaying of her hips in the tight buckskin leggings. Once more the strange howling came from the distant north. It was answered by a second howl to the east, and another from the south. Nuada shivered.
"Wolves?"
he asked. Arion stopped.
"It must be a trick of the wind," she said. "Or a twisted echo. Anyway, it will not trouble us. Wolves keep well clear of people, except in the worst of winter when food is scarce. But even then they can be scared away by a hunter with nerve."
"That howling went through me like a winter wind," he said. She smiled at him.
"That's because you are a city man," she told him.
"So you're not concerned by it?"
"Not at all," she lied.
Mananan, the once knight, sat alone with Olothair the armourer. The cabin was empty, for Gwydion and the family had wandered into the settlement square. Ruad waited for Mananan to speak, but the once knight sat silently staring at the table. Finally, Ruad spoke.
"We need them, Mananan. If they are alive, they must be brought back."
"I cannot do it. I cannot pass the Black Gate." The armourer reached over and gripped Mananan's arm.
"The nation is in great danger. The colours are in disarray. The red is swelling. Nomads are being murdered. Lust, greed, and evil are swamping the harmonies. Do you understand? The king has gathered to him 8 knights. Red knights. I sense their evil. They must be countered, Mananan. Only the knights of the Gabala could hope to stand against them."
"Then you should not have sent them," said Mananan, fixing his gaze to Olothair's. The older man looked away.
"You are right. It was folly of the worst kind, but I cannot put it right."
"Go after them yourself."
"I cannot. There is no one to open the gate this side, and the spell may not be reversible in the other world. You must go."
Mananan laughed and shook his head. "You don't understand. You never did. I came to you the night before the quest began. I told you then of my fears. It was not death that troubled me. I knew that if I passed the gate my soul would be in peril. But no, you would not listen."
"Well, they're gone, Olothair.
You cannot bring them back. They died in whatever hell they found beyond the gate."
"You cannot be sure."
"No, I can't. But if Samuel Danach and the others were alive, they would have found a way back. I'm sure of that. Samuel Danach was almost the wizard you are." Mananan poured water into a clay cup and drained it. Then he stood and looked down at Olothair. "On that last night, I saw Samuel Danach saying farewell to Morrigan. She cried and he left her. I went to her and tried her tears, and she told me she had dreamt strange dreams of blood and fire, of angels and demons. In her heart, she said, she knew she would never see Samuel Danach again. What could I say? But when we stood before the gate and I felt the cold wind blow through it, my courage died. It is the same now. But you do not understand, Olothair. You never did. You never felt the fear that gnaws away at the soul. You could never understand what it is to find yourself a coward. Oh yes, I can face men in battle. I'm confident of my skills. But faced with the gate, I was lost. Even now, when I think of it, my heart races. My breath seems short. I panicked, Olothair. I did it then. I would do it now." He walked to the door and turned. "I am truly sorry."
"Mananan!"
called Ruad, and the warrior swung to face him.
What is it?
I have known that fear. When the king had me in chains and they burned my eye from me. But a man must overcome his fears, or they will overcome him. You are not a coward. It is not death you fear, it is the dark, the unknown, the journey into night. Will you not try to conquer it?
You still do not understand, said Mananan wearily. If I could do it, I would. Can you not see that? What I see is a man who was once a knight of the Gabala, a man who swore an oath to protect and defend the order. Go from here, Mananan. I free you from your oath. Now you can do as you will.
Farewell, armorer, said the once knight. Outside, in the sunlight, he mounted Kuan and rode from the settlement. Death was now assured, he knew, but then death came to all men. He would find a place high in the mountains, and he would cheat his fate. When the pressure on his throat grew great, he would find a way to die that pleased him. He rode throughout the afternoon, ever higher into the tree line, passing cabins and skirting other settlements. Towards dusk, he heard a high-pitched howling from the forest. Kuan's ears pricked, and Mananan felt him shudder.
You have nothing to fear from wolves, great heart, he said, patting the stallion's neck. It is not yet winter.
He rode on, following a narrow track peppered with the spoor of deer. The trees were thicker here, and he ducked low over his saddle to avoid overhanging branches. At the bottom of the track, the ground opened out, and he saw a cabin and a tilled field. Before the cabin lay a man with blood seeping from a terrible wound in his side. The once knight drew his sword and rode warily towards the body. The man was dead. His right arm and half his chest had been torn from him. Kuan whinnied as the smell of blood came to him. By a roughly dug well lay a woman, her head smashed. There was no other wound in evidence. Mananan dismounted and searched the ground. There was no spoor in the immediate vicinity, but he followed a trail of blood from the man's body, until he reached softer earth. Here he found paw marks of great size, like the pad of a lion, but almost a foot across. He knelt by the track and stared off into the undergrowth. The beast had obviously moved off to feed. But why? The bodies could have been devoured where they lay. The beast must have been disturbed. By his arrival? If so, that meant it was still close by. He stood and backed away from the undergrowth. A beast of this size was not something to anger. At that moment a child came running from the trees, saw Mananan and screamed. She was around 9 years old, with long blonde hair, and wearing a tunic of homespun wool. A creature from nightmare moved out behind her. It was huge and double-headed, in part like a lion but wider at the shoulder. Its fangs were long and curved, and each head showed two great incisors, long as sabers. At that instant, Mananan realized the beast had not been disturbed by him, but had moved off in pursuit of the child. He ran towards the girl, but knew he would never reach her before the beast bore her down. He cut to the left, shouting at the top of his voice. The creature's heads swung towards him.
Here, ugliness, Mananan bellowed. Come to me.
The sound of its roaring filled the clearing, and it charged. The once knight stood his ground, his sword held double-handed over his right shoulder, ready for the slashing sweep. As the beast closed on the slender figure, Mananan saw it crouch for the spring, and as it leapt he dropped to one knee, his sword flashing in a disemboweling arc. The blade buried itself in the beast's side as it swept over him, and was almost torn from his hands. In his desperation to keep his grip, Mananan was dragged several yards. He rolled swiftly, but the beast, blood gushing from its side, turned and was upon him. The stallion, Kuan, galloped forward, and hearing the sound of the charging warhorse,
the monster hesitated. Mananan gained his feet and hammered the blade through the neck of the nearest head. The great jaws snapped shut, and the head toppled to hang by a sinew. Blood fountained from the neck. Kuan turned his back on the beast, lashing out with his hind legs, his hooves thundering against the creature's body and hurling it into the air. Mananan rushed in and clove a mighty blow to its remaining head. His blade smashed the skull asunder. The beast reared, and a massive claw raked out at Mananan, catching his helmet. The once knight was torn from his feet as the beast fell and died. Mananan rose. Never had he seen a beast like this, nor heard of any such, in the worlds of civilization. The sound of sobbing broke across his thoughts, and he turned to see the child kneeling by her mother, pulling at the woman's arm. He sheathed his sword and walked over to the child, lifting her to his chest.
"She is dead, girl. I am sorry."
Several men came running from the trees carrying bows and lances, but they stopped, awestruck, by the body of the beast. As the once knight carried the child to them, her arm reached up to touch his helm, and the metal slipped. Swiftly he passed the child to a waiting man and took hold of the helm. The claw had torn away a hinge at the top of the neck plates, and he raised his hands to the metal, but at that moment a thick-set man spoke.
"What is this creature?"
he asked, staring down at the two-headed monster.
"I don't know," replied Mananan, "but I hope it lives alone."
The man held out his hand.
"I'm Liam. We saw you tackling the beast, but we did not think we could reach you in time. Are you a king's man?"
"I am no one's man. Excuse me." He walked slowly away from the group and lifted his hand to the spring bar on his helm.
It slipped sideways. His mouth was dry and he was almost too frightened to raise the helm. Taking a deep breath, he gripped the metal and straightened his arms. The helm grated against the neck plates and then slid loose. His matted hair caught in the rotting leather padding within, but he tore it free. Without the helm in place, the neck plates fell away, draping his shoulders. The wind was cool on his face. His beard was matted and filthy, and sores stung his skin.
"How long have you been wearing that?"
asked Liam, moving to stand beside Mananan.
"Too long. Do you live far from here?"
"No. You're welcome to eat with us."
Hot water and a razor would be a blessing beyond my power to describe, Mananan told him. In the distance came a terrible howling.
"Something has tasted blood," said Liam.
Chapter 8 Ruad heard the screaming and ran from his cabin. In the square beyond, a scaled creature was dragging a man back towards the trees. The beast was over 10 feet long with 6 legs and a long snout, which had fastened to his victim's leg. Several villagers ran at the creature, hammering at it with picks and axes. It released the screaming man only to lunge at a villager, who jumped back. The beast swung, and Ruad watched as its tail cracked out like a whip to circle the legs of one of its attackers and haul him towards its gaping jaws. Ruad knelt beside his golden hounds and whispered the word of power. Then he pointed at the beast and spoke again. The hounds leapt across the square. The first sprang to the creature's back, sinking its steel fangs through scale and bone. The second lunged for the beast's throat, ripping apart flesh and artery. The third fastened its terrible teeth to the tail, trapping the villager. The jaws snapped shut, and the tail parted, green gore pumping from the wound. The ruined tail thrashed wildly, spraying blood across the square, and the hounds backed away. For several seconds, the creature snapped its great jaws at the air. Then it settled slowly to the ground and died. The villagers gathered round the wounded man, and Gwydion came running from a nearby hut to lay his hands on the man's gashed leg. The blood stopped flowing immediately, and Gwydion ordered the injured villager to be carried to his hut. The hounds padded back to Ruad. He touched each on the head, and they froze once more into statues. For several hours, the villagers, armed with bows and axes, searched the woods for more of the creatures. At dusk, they returned, having seen tracks but no monsters. Brion dropped the club he had been carrying and walked to where Ruad sat beside his hounds.
"What manner of beast are they?"
he asked. Ruad shrugged. "It is too complex to explain, my friend, but they're not from here."
"I know that," the villager snapped. "Speak plainly."
"They are from a world beyond our own, summoned here by a sorcerer of great power."
"For what purpose? Merely to kill? Who does that serve?"
"I do not know," answered Ruad, turning away. But Brion was not to be ignored.
"It seems strange to me that first you come with your magic beasts, and then these things follow. I'm not a fool, wizard. Do not treat me like one."
Ruad looked into the young man's square, honest face. "It may be that they were sent to kill me. I do not know. And that is the truth. The world outside this forest is sliding inexorably into evil." Brion was about to say more when the sound of horses' hooves came to them, and a rider cantered into the village. He appeared tall, and his freshly shaven face was ghostly pale. He rode to the cabin and hurled a helm at Ruad's feet. It bounced against the door, rolled, and came to rest against the flanks of a golden hound.
"There," said Manannan, "is your magic helm, the one that could not be released, save by the magic of the gate. Explain that to me, liar, and be convincing, armorer. Much depends on it."
He dismounted and stalked to stand before Ruad.
"Be so kind as to leave us, Brion," requested Ruad, placing his hand on the young man's shoulder. "I will be leaving tonight, and your home will be your own once more."
The young villager nodded, gave Manannan a long stare, and then backed away.
"I am pleased for you," said Ruad. "And yes, I lied. I wanted you to pass the gate. The spell on the helm was loosed the moment we spoke. Are you going to kill me?" "Can you think of a reason why I should not?" Manannan retorted. "Only that I desire to live, and I think I am needed," admitted Ruad.
Manannan shook his head.
"I never was one to kill for the sake of it."
He glanced at the dead beast, still oozing green blood to the dust.
"I killed a creature with two heads today. Now this. What does it mean, Olathair? Where are they from?"
"Beyond the Black Gate, someone has decided to bring terror to the forest."
"And that someone is?"
"I know of no sorcerer powerful enough. But ultimately, it must be the king's doing.
Perhaps they're looking for me. Perhaps for another. It seems to me that evil never needs a sound reason for such deeds as this. Will you help me, Manannan?"
"To do what?"
"To fight the evil. To be what you were trained to be. A knight of the Gabala. Once it meant a great deal to you."
"That was a long time ago."
"But you have not forgotten."
"How could I forget? What would you have me do?"
"You know what is needed."
"No," hissed Manannan. "It is folly."
"The knights must return. I can see no other hope. It is my belief that this evil emanates from the Red Knights of the King. Only the true Gabala can stand against them. Surely you see that."
"What I see is a man with a lunatic dream. The past is gone, Olathair. Dead. Find yourself some new knights. I'll even help you to train them."
"We do not have 5 years, Manannan,"
We may not have 5 months.
Ride through the gate, he pleaded. Find Samil Danach and bring him home. He was the greatest warrior I have ever known, the finest swordsman and the noblest of men. He could help me with the colors. He could stand against the red slayers. Together we could rid the land of this evil.
Now there is a story I've heard before. Rid the world of evil. I did not accept it the first time.
That was an abstract, and I was wrong. Wrong. Is it so terrible to be wrong?
My friends died for the privilege of you being wrong.
You do not know that, Sir Coward Knight, snapped Ruad.
No, I do not. He swung on his heel and walked out into the darkness to stand on the porch, feeling the freshness of the night air on his face. He pictured again the black gate and heard the hideous sounds of the hidden beasts beyond. His heart raced. His hands trembled. He could not pass that portal. He had told Olothair he was afraid for his soul, but that had been a lie, a falsehood enabling him to save face. It was death in the dark, just like the tree of his childhood, trapped in the blackness with ants crawling on his skin. He shivered. And yet would any beast be worse than the horror he had faced today? Even the monsters of the dark. I can't. I'm afraid. Come inside, said Ruad behind him. There is someone I want you to see. He turned and stepped into the doorway, where the one-eyed sorcerer held out a silvered mirror. Manannan took it and gazed at a face he had not seen for 6 years. The eyes accused him, and he looked away.
You cannot run away any more, Manannan. You cannot live your life wondering if your friends are trapped in some deep, dark dungeon. I know you. It will haunt you all your days, and you are no coward. I would never have chosen you otherwise.
Why did you choose me?
Because you were strong in the broken places.
Always riddles with you, Olothair. I'm free now, you said that yourself. Free of my oath. Free of that cursed helm. I do not have to pass the gate.
You are correct in that. It is your choice. But if it would please you, I will beg. I will beg on bended knees.
No, said Manannan softly. I would not like to see that. I will journey with you to the gate, and I will sit Cuan as I did before. But I promise nothing, except to try.
I will open the gate here in the mountains, said Ruad, and once through it, you will find a city. They will have news there.
And they are friendly?
They are gods, Manannan. Wise and immortal. And you will find Samil Danach. I know you will.
Groundsel sat in the long hall staring at his treasury. 3 oak chests, the first half full of gold coin, the second brimming with silver, the third a gleaming pile of jewels and rings and brooches. The royal road was now a rich source of income, as nomad families streamed along it to distant Cithaeron in the hope of a ship to safety. At first, Groundsel had robbed and killed the merchants as they travelled, but the numbers of refugees had halted that simple plan. Had he continued, the road would have become choked with bodies. Now he levied a toll on the escapers, and soon he would be rich enough to leave this accursed forest and sail for warmer climes, where he would buy a palace and fill it with nubile slaves. Groundsel squirmed in his seat at the thought. He knew he was not a handsome man, short, squat, wide-shouldered and bulky. He had none of the clean lines of the athlete. His muscles were ridged and ugly, his body hairy, his arms inordinately long. As a slave, he had been called Ape, and the masters and other servants laughed at him. Then he became Groundsel, for his job was to collect seeds for the feeding of the chickens. The name had weighed on him like a rock. He leaned back in his carved chair, his small button eyes closing, so that he could the better relive the memory of the last day. He had been given a beating by the senior servant, Joappa, and the whip had peeled away the skin of his back. He was taking it as he took all beatings, in a grim and defiant silence. When he saw the master's wife grinning by the door of the barn, that dreadful smile carried all the weight of his anger and his shame, and it smote him with tongues of fire. He crouched and turned, grabbing the whip from Joappa's hand and smashing a fearful blow to the servant's face. The man crumpled without a sound. Then Groundsel had leapt upon the startled woman, dragging her back into a hay-covered stall and ripping her clothes from her. She had been too terrified to scream, and his rage turned to lust. When he'd finished with her, he stood and retied his leggings, then he tapped his chest and looked down at her.
"Groundsel," he said, "the ape. Now you are the ape's leavings. What does that make you?"
He strode from the barn with blood seeping from his whipped back and walked up the marble stairs into the house. The shocked servant tried to stop him, but he rammed the man's head into a wall and climbed the winding stair. The master was sitting in his study with his son, an arrogant young noble fond of riding and whoring. It was the boy who reacted first.
"Get out, you miserable peasant," he ordered.
Groundsel smiled and hammered his fist into the boy's face. The older man ran towards his desk and swept up a dagger, but Groundsel was upon him before he could draw it from its scabbard, and dragging the man to the wide balcony, he pushed him against the edge.
"I have raped your wife. I will kill your son. Die with that thought."
The old man screamed once, as Groundsel toppled him from the high balcony to crash to the marble flagstones. The rebel slave grinned as he saw his master's head split like a melon. Taking the dagger, he cut the throat of the unconscious youth, then walked back to the stables and saddled a gelding. The wife still lay where he had left her. He thought of killing her, but decided that to leave her was a greater punishment. And he rode for the forest. He had been foolish then, for he had not robbed the house, and it was 2 years before he had gained mastery of the first outlaw band he joined. Now, 5 years later, he was the undisputed master of the Western Wood. 5 settlements paid tribute to him, and the royal road was making him richer than he had dreamed possible. He had thought to give himself another name, a proud name. Yet he had not. Groundsel was how he saw himself, and the sound of the name added fuel to his hatred. He closed the chests and dragged them back to their hiding place in the false wall. It was not much of a hiding place, but few would dare to approach Groundsel's quarters in his absence. He rubbed at his close-cropped black hair.
"Rich you are," he told himself. Yet something was lacking. It was curious, but until today he had not known what it was. Then the girl, Ariane, had walked into the settlement, along with the poet Nuada.
Groundsel watched her hip-swinging stride, her honey-gold hair blowing in the breeze, her high, proud head. A need flared in him like a summer fire. He felt hot as he drank in her beauty. His mouth was dry. He rubbed the back of his hand over his face and then glanced at his fingers, noticing for the first time in days that they were filthy. Ducking back inside the hall, he rummaged through another chest, which contained clothing he had stolen from his first forest victims. He found a shirt of yellow silk and took it out, along with a pair of brown leather trews and a belt emblazoned with silver circles. Then he ran from the rear of the hall to the stream. Some women were washing clothes there, so he moved upstream and bathed, scrubbing himself with mint leaves and lavender blossoms. He wiped the surplus water from his body with his hands and dressed swiftly. The shirt was on the large side, but the sleeves were far too short. He rolled back the cuffs and pulled on the trews. Again, they were too long. Removing them, he took his knife and cut several inches from each leg. Once dressed, he returned to the hall to welcome his guests. Like many others in the forest, he had heard of the poet, and his first invitations had been courteously refused. Then Groundsel had sent a messenger with a gold coin and the promise of more. The man had better be worth it, he had decided, or he'd cut his ears off. Arion and Nuada were waiting in the cool of the southern entrance when Groundsel appeared. Nuada gave a courtly bow which pleased the robber, while Arion merely smiled. Groundsel's delight was complete.
"Enter! Enter!" he said. "Welcome. I've heard wondrous tales of your skill, Master Poet. I trust you will not disappoint us, poor folk that we are."
Nuada bowed again.
"My Lord Groundsel, I can only hope that my poor talents prove worthy of the trust implicit in your invitation."
"I am no lord," said Groundsel, sitting back on his chair and ordering wine to be brought for his guests. "Just a poor man trying to do his best for the people who need him. These are hard times, but I am not a lord, nor would I want to be."
"A lord," said Nuada, "is a man who commands respect from those who serve him, or fear from those obliged to serve him. He should also be a man of courage and leadership. Last year, I am told, a great fire sprang up, and men turned to you to save them. You organized bands of workers, dug a fire ditch, cleared the ground before the blaze, and yourself worked alongside your men. That is heroic leadership, my lord, sharing the dangers and inspiring your followers."
Groundsel was lost for words. The fire would have destroyed his granary, and winter would have brought starvation and an end to his leadership. Could the fool not see that? But the words were pleasing, and he was beginning to see the value of his investment in the poet. He turned his attention to the girl, asking her name and straining to be cool and pleasant. He talked to them for an hour before having them escorted to an empty hut at the western edge of the village. When his men returned to explain that the woman and the man were not together, desired separate accommodation, he was overjoyed. He ordered a second dwelling cleared, the resident family being moved to an overcrowded hut to the north. Naturally, there was no argument. Back at the first dwelling, Marion turned to Nuada.
"You flatterer! Oh, my dear Lord Groundsel, what a hero you are," she mocked.
Nuada grinned at her.
"And you, I suppose, offered nothing by way of flattery yourself."
"What do you mean by that?" "He all but climbed into your breeches, but you just stood by smiling provocatively. Do not think to lecture me. I was raised at court, where the wrong word or look could see a man ruined, or worse. This is no different. Groundsel is like a king here, and to go against him could result in unpleasant consequences." "We are here on safe conduct," she reminded him.
"Oh, grow up, Arion. Safe conduct? The man is a savage. However, he is a rich savage, so that gives me a reason for being here. But if you will take my advice, you will leave as soon as it is dark."
Arion had already decided on that very course of action, but the poet's words stung her.
"I shall do nothing of the sort. I will leave tomorrow after breakfast. I wouldn't miss your performance before these rabble for a gold piece."
He shrugged. "As you will.
I should have known better than to advise a woman so worldly wise. But when he drags you to his bed, I think you will find there is a pig inside that silk shirt."
"Jealous poet, are you attracted to men?"
She hurled the question like a barb, and was furious when he laughed at her.
"You are angry, Arion," he said. "Was I not attentive enough on the journey here? Did you expect me to ask you to share my blanket? How remiss of me!
The truth of his words made her blush furiously. Had he so invited her, she would have refused, but she'd expected him to make an advance. Her hand snaked out to crack against his cheek. For a moment, anger flared. Then he smiled, bowed, and left the hut. Arion watched him go, then swore under her breath. The poet was right. It was foolish to trust Groundsel's safe conduct. And yet she'd only risked this journey in the hope that it would inspire some concern in the heart of Chlor Givus. In that she had failed miserably. She pictured Groundsel and his lust-filled eyes and slowly pulled the hunting knife from its sheath at her side. The edge was honed to razor sharpness and curled up into a double-edged crescent. Drag her to his bed. She slid the knife back in its scabbard and waited. Arion sat beside Groundsel as Nuada stood on a central table and wove his spell over the 70 or so men who had crowded into the hall. His talent filled the room, his voice mellow and musical, his words rich and rolling, his stories vivid and compelling. Even Arion, who often found the battles of men incomprehensible, was swept along by his tales of heroes and maidens, swordsmen and sorcerers. His delivery was subtly different here, she noticed, more quick fire and the stories less romantic, as if he had gauged his audience in the moment that he stepped to the table. The heroes he spoke of were common men, who had risen to the ranks of the great or who had fought against the evils of the monarchy in times past. Groundsel was as spellbound as his men, his dark eyes fixed on the poet. Nuada closed his performance with the tale of the Great Fire and Groundsel's part in it, emphasizing the strength of character and the powers of leadership that were gifts from the gods to men of certain futures. The hall exploded with applause, and Nuada bowed to the audience, then turned to bow even lower in Groundsel's direction. The outlaw leader stood and returned the bow. Bathed in sweat, Nuada leapt from the table, swept up a flagon of ale, and downed it.
"You are a man of great talent," Groundsel told him as he joined the outlaw and Arion at the far end of the hall.
"My talent would be as nothing without the exploits of heroes, my lord."
"How did you come to hear of the fire?"
"Everywhere I've travelled, men talk of it," Nuada answered. Arion leaned back and shook her head. She said nothing. Early in the evening, Groundsel had put his arm around her, stroking her neck or patting her thigh. But when Nuada had begun speaking, he had forgotten her presence. It was galling. And as for the fire, everyone knew how Groundsel had done nothing until his own granary was threatened. 3 villages were destroyed and 14 people died before he even stirred from his own settlement. In that moment, Arion came close to hating Nuada for glorifying the incident. Groundsel turned to her and grinned. Sweat had drenched the yellow silk shirt and it was creased over his bulging belly. His hand pawed at her thigh.
"You are a fire in my blood," he whispered, pushing wet lips against her cheek.
She blushed deeply and pulled away from him, but his brawny arm circled her shoulder to drag her in against him. The door at the far end of the hall opened and 2 men entered. The first was drenched in blood. The second was Chlor Givus. Chlor supported the wounded man, helped him to a chair. Men rushed towards them, blocking Arianne's view. Groundsel leapt to his feet and ran forward, knocking aside any in his way.
"What in the devil's name is going on?" he roared.
Chlor stood and faced the shorter man.
"There are beasts loose in the forest. I have never seen their like. I found this man crawling in the undergrowth about a mile away to the east. He said his family had been slaughtered. I carried him halfway here, then I saw one of them, 8 to 10 feet tall, with the head of a wolf and a body like a bear. It was feeding on a slaughtered bull and ignored me. In the distance, I saw a second creature. I would swear it had two heads. Noise erupted all around them, for many of the men at the hall had homes in the woods and valleys beyond, and had travelled in to hear Nuada.
"Silence!" bellowed Groundsel, kneeling by the wounded man and ripping the blood-drenched shirt from him. Four jagged tears had gouged his chest, and it was obvious from the lines that it had been a single slash. That made the paw a prodigious size. No bear could match it, not even the towering black grizzly of the high mountains.
"Carry him to the witch woman," ordered Groundsel, "or he'll bleed to death."
As the man was carried out, Groundsel turned to Claw.
"You saw two of them? How do you know there are more?"
The tall warrior scratched at his red-gold beard.
"Howling," he said simply. "The beast, by the bull, let out a howl, and it was answered from many points."
"Aye, I heard the strange howling," said a man. "It was from the north. I thought it a trick of the wind."
"And I saw a track," put in another. "On the way here, Groundsel. Big, twice the size of a lion's."
Other men began to shout, and the clamour grew.
"What a night for heroes,"
came a voice, and the crowd swung to see the poet standing on his table once more. "If there are two beasts savaging the countryside, are there not heroes enough here to hunt them down? We have Groundsel, the Lord of the Fire, and Chlor Givis, who freed the prisoners. And as I look around me, I see other men, strong men, proud men. There is a saga waiting out there, and I shall sing it. We will place the carcasses at the far end of the hall and build a fire and dance, and your bravery will become immortal." Those in the crowd screamed their approval and moved to the walls to gather their bows and knives.
"Wait!" yelled Groundsel. "It will be dawn soon, and I'll have no wild men rushing around in the darkness sending shafts after everything that moves. We'll kill more of each other than any beast."
Chlor nodded. "We'll need to lure them into a trap. I have no wish to walk into a darkened lair hunting the things."
"Get some rest,"
Groundsel told the men, then stalked back to his seat. Arion rose as Chlor approached.
"I did not expect to see you this far west," she said. "Are you lost?"
"I'd intended to leave for Sithaeron, but the howling disturbed me," he told her. "I tried to skirt it, but I sensed the beasts at my scent, so I cut west." "What do you make of it, poet?"
Nuada shrugged.
"There are many songs in legend about werebeasts, but I have never seen one. It is said that, far to the east, there is a rich land where the mines are dug by giant ants with the heads of men." Groundsel swore.
"It is always far to the east, or the west, or the north. It seems to me that legends always originate far from where men can study them. However, that hardly matters. I too have heard the howling, but I doubt not that the size of the creatures is exaggerated. We are dealing with a rogue bear, large, but still a bear."
Chlor reddened. "It is not wise to call a man a liar, especially a man you do not know."
"You have it right, Strong Ant. I do not know you, therefore I have no reason to trust either you or your judgment. I say it is a bear. The dawn will tell."
"Indeed it will," agreed Chlor. "Until then, I will sleep."
"I'll show you to my hut," said Arianne swiftly,
and now it was Groundsel whose colour darkened.
"Is this your man?" he demanded, his eyes bright.
"No," she replied. "He is a friend of my family."
"Good," said Groundsel. "I look forward to the hunt with your friend of the family."
Chlor tensed, but Arianne seized his arm and the two of them left the hall and wandered out into the night.
The gates of the stockade were once more shut, and guards patrolled the wall.
"Why did you come here?"
Chlor asked.
"You want to be bedded by that son of a sow?" "How dare you!"
"I go where I will. I'm not your daughter. You have no right to question me."
"True enough," he admitted.
Just then a piercing scream echoed from the woods, and Chlor ran to the stockade wall and mounted the rough-cut ladder to the palisade.
"Can you see anything?" he asked the sentry.
"No," replied the man. "But Darek slipped out about 10 minutes ago. He was trying to get back to his family. What is the beast?"
"I do not know," replied Chlor, "but it's no damn bear."
A black shadow moved from the trees, halted in the moonlight, and looked up at the stockade. The sentry stared in horror at the grisly remains it was dragging.
"Darek did not make it," stated Chlor.
"I want no part in hunting that thing," said the sentry.
Chlor watched until the beast moved back into the trees. Then he slapped the sentry on the shoulder.
"Think of the saga," he said.
The man's reply was short, foul, and to the point, and Chlor chuckled. Arion still stood staring into the blackness of the forest.
"Can such a beast be killed by arrows?" she asked.
"It lives and breathes," said Chlor. "Therefore it can die. Now show me this hut." Chlor Giffers could not sleep as he lay on the narrow cot bed in the small hut. He could hear Arion breathing beside him, and yearned to reach out and touch her, to draw her to him. Guilt washed over him. Lydia had been the love of his life, and their few years together had filled him with a happiness he could never have known without her. As a young apprentice, he had courted her for 4 years, and had worked hard to save the money for his own smithy. Lydia's father had always maintained that he was not the man for her, and had dreamed of marrying her to a young nobleman. He had disdained their wedding, and had not spoken to Chlor again. He died 3 years after the marriage. Lydia's mother had moved north to be with her family, but she at least had always treated Chlor with courtesy, if not with love. Through it all, Chlor had been filled with a burning desire to make Lydia happy. But at the end, her father had been right. Lydia died a terrible death, one that would have been avoided had she not married the giant smith. He would never forget the sight of her lying on the bed, her dead eyes staring up at the ceiling. Yet now he lay with another woman, and his thoughts were not innocent of desire. He rolled to his side, facing away from Arianne. He could smell the perfume of her body and see, without seeing, the oval beauty of her face, the sparkling challenge of her eyes, and her mocking smile.
"Are you awake?"
she whispered, and he heard her body move on the bed. He did not reply. There was nothing to say. He was being betrayed by his body, which yearned for her, and even his mind was at war. It is natural, he told himself, for a man to desire a mate. Tragedy could not change that. And yet, if he found peace and love with another woman, would not that make him forget Lydia? And then she would be truly dead, lost and forgotten, as if she had never been. He could not stomach that thought. She had not deserved her fate and did not deserve this treachery now. Chlor lay silently until the dawn, then rose and watched the rising sun. Beside him, Arion lay sleeping, her arms tight against her body, her long legs curled up like a child. Chlor looked down at her. His fingers brushed the hair back from her cheek, and he felt the softness of her skin. Her eyes opened as he touched her.
"Did you sleep well?"
she asked, yawning and stretching. Her shirt slid up to expose an inch of midriff, and Chlor moved away to the door. Outside the men were gathering, and he saw Groundsel dressed now in hunting leather and carrying a bow.
The squat outlaw leader was also wearing two short swords with curved blades. Chlor gathered his double-headed hand axe and joined the men. Nuada waved and approached him.
"It should be quite a day," said the poet, grinning. "The sun is high, the sky is clear. Tonight will be a fine time for feasting."
"You have no idea of what today will be, poet. This is not a stag hunt. Are you coming with us?"
"Of course. How can I tell the saga if I do not witness it?"
"That does not seem to have affected your talents thus far," observed Chlor. The group split into three sections, and scouts were sent out to search for spoor. Chlor went with Groundsel, Arion, Nuada, and three others, and led them back along the trail to where he had seen the beast feeding. They found traces of blood and a few split bones and several enormous tracks, but of the creature there was no sign. They stopped at midday by a stream and sat in a circle around a small fire.
"It has gone to ground," said Arion. "I think it must be sleeping in a cave somewhere, but the ground to the north is rocky and will not be able to track it."
"Then we must bring it to us," stated Groundsel. "Last night it slew one of my men, so we know it has a taste for human meat."
"You keep saying it," Chlor remarked.
"But there are more of them." "So you say," snapped the outlaw leader. "This is my plan. We will journey back to the point of its last feeding and wait. It has probably buried some meat there and will return after dark."
"We will fight this creature at night?" Arion whispered. "What if the clouds gather? Without a hunter's moon, the archers will be useless."
Groundsel grinned.
"We will sit by a fire, your friends here and I, and we will talk, swap stories. You and the other archers will be hidden nearby in the trees, out of harm's way. I think the beast will come to us."
"This is madness," said Arion. "What will it prove?"
Groundsel's eyes flickered towards Nuada. Then he shrugged.
"Can you think of a better plan, Chlor Givers?"
"As you wish," Chlor muttered. "But I think you should gather in all the hunters. This creature will withstand many arrows." After the meal, Groundsel ordered one of his men to sound the horn, and the hunting parties converged to meet at a pre-selected spot, on a high hillside overlooking the stockade. Here, a change was made to the original plan. For the first hunting group had found the remains of Darek's family half buried in a tree-shrouded hollow.
"It will return," said Groundsel. "Did you leave the bodies where they were?"
"We did,"
replied a tall, lean hunter named Dubarin, his face still grey with the shock of the find.
"Believe me, Groundsel, the beast is large. Its stride length is over 7 feet. It is no bear. As the poet said, we will nail its carcass to the hall doors tonight."
Some of the men were sent back to the stockade, but Groundsel, Chlor, Nuada, and Arion journeyed into the hills with 20 bowmen, arriving at Darek's cabin an hour before dusk. They were led to the bodies by Dubarin, who stopped short of the grisly grave and waved them on.
"I have no need to see it again," he said, turning aside.
"I don't want to see it at all," declared Nuada, backing away.
But Chlor Givers grabbed his arm and hauled him forward.
"Come now, poet, you can't sing of it if you haven't seen it."
Nuada struggled, but Chlor's grip was like iron, and he was dragged to the shallow grave. An arm jutted from beneath the earth, and the half-eaten corpse of a young woman lay exposed, her entrails covered in dirt. Part of a child's body lay close by. Nuada gagged and twisted away to vomit on the ground. Chlor knelt beside him.
"Now, you see," he said, "this is not some song. There are no elven princes, no flame-breathing dragons.
I shall listen to your tale with interest if we survive.